Hi, and welcome to Music Production with Mike and Dan. Because this is our debut episode, we wanted to say a few things about ourselves and, you know, just sort of give you a heads up as to what our areas of expertise are. So I'm Mike Fragomeni. I'm a former MCA recording artist. I've been in a bunch of bands. I have recorded lots of bands over the course of the last 30 plus years. I primarily specialize in rock and roll, rock music, different kinds of rock music, alternative rock, punk rock, stuff like that, garage rock. And yeah, that's basically it. But you know, my main focus is music production, not so much engineering. I've done my share of engineering over the years, and I've worked in analog studios, and I now have a digital studio that I work in, but I tend to focus more on music production and not so much engineering. And Dan?
Hi, I'm Dan Wool. I consider myself historically mostly a film score composer, but for a very long time, I've produced all my own stuff in my home studio for almost all the projects. Occasionally, I'll go into other studios to record, but I'm mostly a film score composer, but I'm also a mixing engineer as well as a recording engineer at various times. I like to do that whenever I can, and I do film mixing as well. And so, yeah, I do whatever it takes to sort of pay the bills, basically, with sound and music.
Yeah, and both Dan and I have our associations with very well-known artists. You know, I don't want that to be the focus of this. I would rather this podcast be more about our knowledge and what we're trying to share with the listener. But we will occasionally, because we both have a tendency to reminisce about past, you know, experiences, past sessions, and in the process, names will come up. But I just figured, you know, when it does, it does. And
it's who we are. It's what else do we have, Mike?
Right, exactly. I've known Dan since 1986?
You're the one who keeps better with dates. You probably know what day, and you can tell me what we had for coffee.
Yeah, I don't remember the day, but I do remember it was, I'm pretty sure it was 86, maybe even 85. It was either late 85 or early 86. And been good friends ever since. And Dan is one of the first people that I know to sort of just fully embrace the DAW, the digital audio workstation. Back in those days, in the early 90s, it was toxic to me. I could not stand digital. And Dan was like, "What's wrong, Mike? This is great." Like, you know, tape sucks. You know, tape is a flawed format. You know, I remember you saying stuff like that to me. And ironically, my album that I did with MCA, we were one of the first bands to use Pro Tools. We did record it on, you know, analog, you know, 24-track, 2-inch, two Studer decks. So I guess it was 48 tracks. But our producer at the time, Jerry Harrison, see, there's the first name
first drop.
First name drop.
Take a drink.
Yeah. Jerry was one of the first guys to really get into Pro Tools. So we also did tracks. We synchronized tracks so that we could take advantage of Pro Tools at the time. Now this was, I want to say this is Pro Tools version 2 we were using.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. And this is 1991 and it just kept on crashing. It was so unreliable. And he had one of those really small Apple computers, you know, the original ones. But, you know, he had the rack mount with the... What does Pro Tools have?
It was TDM. It might have been TDM back then, whatever their proprietary protocol was there. But yeah, they'd come in racks of... I think there'd be four tracks for each of the racks.
Yeah, yeah.
If you had more, you could do more. But then you had to have more cards in your computer. And there was stuff called Nubus chassis. And it was just a big mess.
Yeah, it was not reliable at all. There's a few songs on that record that we did actually wind up using Pro Tools. So there is actually, you know, we didn't just use Pro Tools. It was actually became part of the album.
Right, and Jerry, yeah, he was kind of ahead of the curve, and like so, you were probably like just discovering all the possibilities of digital audio at that point, because he was like, yeah, he was probably guessing that he had an endorsement from DigiDesign, which is who owned Pro Tools at that time.
So right.
Yeah, he was like sort of a pioneer in that area as far as production goes.
I'm pretty sure he did. He did have some sort of deal with DigiDesign, if I remember correctly. Yeah,
as you may recall, he got me our first Pro Tools rig at some sort of discount. I don't remember if it was a discount or he just made it available. But yeah, he hooked us up, the group that I was in. I didn't mention I was once in a group called Pray for Rain. I was in this group in the 80s into the 90s. But yeah, and so, and he had hooked us up with a Pro Tools rig, and that's how I got into it. He basically set us up with what I got in, with what I ended up working with for many years.
I actually didn't even know that the link there was Jerry. That's interesting.
That's why I was like so friendly with you.
Okay. I know we had the same management, that much I do remember.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's probably the Jerry connection came via Chris Coyle.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, and Chris was all over this whole thing. So, but yeah, but we had nailed down we were going to do, Pray for Rain was going to do an episodic TV show, which had at least 12 episodes, ended up being only 12 episodes, but I didn't want to go into the studio to do that. And so I figured out it'd be a lot easier and faster and cheaper just to have basically in my bedroom in my house, a Pro Tools rig, which is what we had.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought that we were going to talk about four tracks in this.
We are.
And so to tie that in, I believe that first rig, they came with four tracks. And so we were recording digitally with four tracks, and then everything else was running via SMPTE code from tape. All the other stuff would be running MIDI tracks into a DAT. And so we would have four audio tracks and then a lot of MIDI tracks that would be going through a mixer and then mixed onto two track onto a DAT was the workflow back then.
Right, right. Our topic for today is going to be four tracking. But before we get into that, I thought it would be helpful or beneficial to the listener if we also just sort of said, like, what is our mission statement with this podcast? Why are we doing this, basically? I believe, answering my own rhetorical question, that there are many, many podcasts and videos out there that primarily deal with engineering. When I go on YouTube and I have a question, I can't figure something out. 2 seconds, I can go on YouTube and there's a dozen or more videos answering my question, but it's almost always on engineering. How to get a sound, how to mix a vocal, how to get a drum sound, you know, whatever. What if bass is clicking too much? All of those are engineering questions and answers. But I realized at one point there really aren't that many podcasts or videos of YouTube channels that primarily focus on music production. And I think the reason why is because a lot of producers out there closely guard their secrets. It's like your recipe, your secret recipe. You don't want to tell people how you made that song sound so great, because if you're a really good producer, you want to protect those secrets. And I don't really believe that. I think most producers all know the same stuff. You know, I think it really comes down more to your ears and just how good you are and you know, how well you know the material, not so much about secrets.
Yeah, and I also think that a lot of producers, I think it's instinctual a lot of times, and they don't necessarily know what they're doing. It's like it's kind of hard to put on a YouTube video and a how-to YouTube video. And so I think that just by discussing it between you and I, some of those ideas will come clear, because there are different producers. There are some producers that are really good engineers. I think that, Bob Clearmount, that level, that guy can engineer just as well as he can produce. But then we got Rick Rubin, who doesn't even know what faders do. I mean, he famously could be part of his thing, but he goes out of his way to tell you how untechnical he is. And he's completely instinctual. So, yeah, so it's an interesting sort of category. And it's like the term producer is always, it's worth having a podcast just because no one really knows what it is. I mean, it's such a nebulous title that that I get asked that a lot. What does a producer do anyway?
Right.
And I don't have a good answer. It depends on what it depends on the project and sometimes the producer will just like get the studio and rent the gear and makes it happen on some level. I mean, that would be the most sort of basic definition, is that they make it happen on some level.
Right. And that's more analogous to film, where the producer in film is more about making the project happen, supporting the project in whatever way, whereas the director is more the creative visionary. And then you have the cinematographer, who to me is more like an engineer is in a recording studio. So, I don't know if Tarantino is good with a camera. Maybe he is. I haven't really read about that. There's probably articles saying whether he is or not. But I know that he's a visionary, and I know that he likes to get shots a certain way, and he needs to be working with a cinematographer who understands that and can get him that shot. So that's the way I've always, George Martin, who's someone I'm going to be referencing a lot, because George Martin's probably the reason why I got into producing music. George Martin, who is a producer of the Beatles. But then there's Jeff Emmerich, who is his main engineer. And I always think of their relationship as more or less being like that. I don't know that George Martin was the guy who put the microphone here to get this kind of guitar tone or whatever. I don't know. I know that there's that famous bass tone that McCartney gets by using a speaker, right? Isn't it like he uses the speaker as a microphone?
Oh, yeah. Okay. As a transducer and just picks it up. Sure. That's a technique that people still do, but yeah.
Right, of course. But I can't, I off the top of my head, I don't know if that was George Martin's idea or if it was Jeff Emmerich's or maybe some other engineer in the room. I don't know. But there's a distinction there because I think of George Martin as the guy who, and this is more or less what I think a really good music producer, a creative music producer does. He's the guy that knows, first and foremost, when it's the take. Like that's really, you got to start there. You have to have good enough ears to know. The singer's sitting there going like, oh no, I was flat. And you're like, no, that's the take, dude. Yeah, you were flat a little bit. The energy was, that's the take.
Yeah, that's true. And George Martin was really good at that kind of thing, especially, and it was crucial back then. I mean, now I just go, oh, that was pretty good. Let's do four more. I mean, because it's all digital, but back then.
Right.
It was a work. It took a long time to rewind. It was like, you know, you had to go back and listen. And then the tape cost money, even for the Beatles, even watching Get Back. They talk about that. It's like it still becomes a concern because it does cost some money to do that. So that was a way important skill back then to be able to go, nope, that's it. Or the one, three ago was the one. But George Martin, I think, is a great example of a well-rounded producer with that term because he could also probably engineer as good as anybody in the room. Plus, he could do arrangements, and he was really good at arrangements and suggesting arrangements. And he could do orchestration. He did it all. And so he was really, he kind of set the gold standard for what a producer would be. And I think very few reach that level, actually.
Right. And let's not forget, it was George Martin who decided Pete Best was just not a good drummer.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
I mean, there's someone posted on YouTube, I think it's Love Me Do, and they said, well, you know, well, is he, like, wasn't Pete Best okay? Like, I mean, the Beatles played with him in Hamburg and all this stuff. It's like, okay, let me just show you. So they have, like, the beginning of Love Me Do, and then they take the end of Love Me Do, and they sort of, they compare them, and you can literally hear how much this guy sped up. It's just like, I don't know how many beats per minute, but he, like, sped up a lot. And, you know, over the course of the song, you know, you don't notice it as much unless you have really good ears, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, it starts off a certain tempo, it speeds up a little bit here and a little bit there, but then by the end of the song, it's like, you know, it's not a mid-tempo pop song anymore. And so, you know, Martin, of course, his ears were good enough to hear that. He's like, you guys need a better drummer. So there's that kind of producer. There's the producer who has the good ears and, you know, is just on top of that. And that's really important, especially for the old style of, even before multitrack. And I know multitrack goes back to Les Paul and, you know, the 50s and stuff, but most studios weren't set up. Most studios were still mono. And in many instances, they recorded with one mic. And being a good producer in those days was really about where you put the mic. Like having good enough ears to know and knowing the microphone, if it's one of those old RCA mics, I can't remember what the number is, but you're familiar with those.
Yeah.
And you know, they had the figure eight pattern. And so you could literally move that mic around and it had a dead spot, you know? So you'd more often than not, if you were recording a band, like let's just say Elvis in the 50s, they knew to turn the dead spot, the phantom spot of the mic towards the drums. You know, and then they would have, you know, the singer sing on the one side and then the other side also was active. And you'd have the other musicians, maybe the guitar and bass positioned in such a way where, you know, you'd get a good blend. So you're basically mixing with one mic. There was no mixing in those days. Your mix was happening when you did the recording.
Right.
And once again, you had to be a good enough producer and have good enough ears to not only know when it's a good take, but when it's the right blend. So there's that skill that is needed if one is going to be a really good producer, right?
Right. So there's always going to be an element of engineering with producing as well. So it's like this sort of like cross, it's like a lot of disciplines involved in what I would call a producer.
Right. The next thing a producer has to be really good at is now we're getting into a different kind of recording, which George Martin was also really good at, more or less created it. I think there's a few other guys that we could credit this, but it's when sound recordings become works of art in their own right, like a canvas. Now, there are a lot of traditionalists and purists who, you know, don't like this and they've never liked it. You know, I remember there was an interview with Eric Clapton and he was watching on a TV show, Les Paul was demonstrating the multi-track recorder. Mm-hmm. And he was into it mainly because he was a Les Paul fan. But his mom said something like, well, that's just cheating, you know? You know, because, you know, it's like, oh, she saw that like Les Paul was playing all these different guitar parts and they were all him. And she's like, well, that's cheating. Like, you know, that's not really music.
Right.
Yeah. So there are people who actually believe that. Now, that's just 180 degrees from the way I feel. I mean, the reason why I record and the reason why I love music production is because of what the Beatles did, you know, when they stopped touring and starting around, I guess it would be Rubber Soul or Revolver.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how recordings became works of art in their own right. And once again, a great producer knows how to do this. And this is the segue for us to talk about four tracking, which is really the topic of this episode.
Okay.
And four tracks are not a lot. I mean, people listen to this who record in their houses with, you know, DAWs, and there's like tracks are unlimited, you know? So this, the idea that you would be limited by tracks is just so unheard of these days. But creating those boundaries and having that challenge where you've got four tracks, how are you going to make it sound professional? How are you going to make it sound like something that's on the radio right now? You know,
one of the things we're always looking for as artists is parameters. And so that was one of these hard parameters. And I mean, when you first brought this, the idea of this subject up to me, I was like, oh, does that mean we're going to be talking about the old days and how we used to do it? But, and we are, I think, but there was, but I did learn a lot just about how instruments interact with each other, because I was forced to listen to them one at a time and then bounce them together onto using just four tracks. And right. So it's definitely those parameters. I kind of miss them in a way. I mean, I definitely don't miss them in a lot of other ways. But there was something very sort of simple about the parameters when you're using a four-track.
For me, my first experience with four-track was an old TIAC, you know, reel-to-reel four-track. I wound up recording a couple songs, and it was—
Quarter-inch reel-to-reel, right?
Quarter-inch reel-to-reel TIAC four-track with a little Tascam mixer or something like that. And so that was my first experience. I didn't get to spend a lot of time with the four tracking on that. And I didn't really know a lot of the tricks yet, because I didn't have the experience.
Mm-hmm.
So on that recording, I recorded drums and I just used one or two mics through a mixer.
You were engineering this project?
Yeah, I was engineering it. Yeah.
You rented this recorder from the guy?
He had it at his house. He had like a little studio set up on Miami Beach. and he had like this little studio setup, and it was cool. Like, it was like kind of like where he rehearsed, but then he also had the four track in there, and he had microphones, and like, you know, 57s and 58s. They weren't great microphones.
He didn't engineer?
No.
Oh.
No. As a matter of fact, he kind of didn't even know how to use the thing. Uh-huh. It was kind of sad, because he had like good gear, but he was really like one of these wannabe musician guys. Like, he played a little bit of guitar, but he really just liked people to come over, and he liked to hang out with musicians. And
yeah,
you know, he would just charge a little bit of money. You know, he wasn't really making a lot of money off. He wasn't like ripping anyone off, but it was a long way for me to go. I was living in North Miami. So yeah, it wasn't like I could just go there whenever I wanted. I had to like book the time with him. And I got this drummer. He's a really good drummer. And I set up one or two mics, and I put the drums on one track. I overdubbed bass on another track.
And you and just, then, did you go to the library and look at where microphones should go?
No, not at all. not at all. The drummer had a little bit of engineering experience, so when I was recording his drums, he said, oh, yeah, it's better if we're only going to do one mic or two mics, you should put them here. And I was, okay, thanks. But the point I'm trying to make is that there was no bouncing, because I didn't know to bounce. And so I still have this recording to this day, which is amazing. I still have it. Most people record the way that I recorded on that four track, but with more tracks, because if you have unlimited tracks because you have Pro Tools or whatever. I didn't know that you could record something on tracks 1, 2, and 3. Let's just say drums on 1, bass on 2, rhythm guitar on 3, and then bounce them to 4. Now 4 is your rhythm section. It's stuck in mono. It's frozen, but you have 3 more tracks to play with. I didn't know that. So what I went for was just linear, what I call linear takes. I had 1 drum track, I had 1 bass track, I had a guitar track, and then I had a vocal, and that was it. I had 4 tracks. It actually became more like a live recording if you stop and think about it.
That's exactly what it is. What else would it be?
Oh, it's a live recording with me as a clone, like, because I'm playing all the instruments. So that's where the overdubbing made it possible.
Oh, yeah,
for me.
Of course, right.
Because, you know, I'm playing bass and guitar and singing. I can't play bass guitar and regular guitar at the same time.
Yeah, you're just using it to overdub, yeah, right.
My next experience with the four track was when I moved to New York and my roommate had a little Fostex four track, a little cassette, you know, the cassette ones. And this was different because this time I live there and he gave me permission to use the four track whenever I wanted, as long as I didn't break it. And I just got really good at it. I understood how to bounce because I would go and listen to Beatle records and I knew that the Beatles only had four tracks.
That was like the mantra. It's like, well, Beatles, look what they could do with just four tracks. I mean, it really wasn't quite that simple because they had the best four-track machines and they were bouncing to the best four-track machine. Like the technology as good as it could get. So, but we were always like, yeah, if the Beatles could do it with four tracks, look what we should be able to do something, you know, at least close.
Yeah, because they had that Studer one-inch four-track deck.
Right.
You know, like the thickest. Yeah. I think to this day, that's still the thickest.
Yeah, four-inch, yeah, four-track, one-inch, yeah.
Right. Because then each track is a quarter inch.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the widest, you know, like analog imprint you could have.
Yeah.
So, yeah, of course. I didn't know this at the time. I'm recording on this little dinky cassette. And I'm thinking, like, hey, four tracks is four tracks.
How come it doesn't sound like the Beatles? Yeah,
exactly. Mm. But what it did was it forced me to listen to those recordings and understand the production, what George Martin was doing. And what I mean by this is if you have a track, and a track is linear, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have all these ideas of all these different instruments you want to put in a song. The way to do it is not to say, okay, here's track three right now. Track three now is going to become a keyboard part or something that's just going to play, you know, maybe in the choruses. But then you've got nothing going on in the verses on that track.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not getting the most out of that track.
Right.
We could say the same thing about track two and track one, whatever. What I started doing was just maximizing. I was just, you know, loading those tracks with as much stuff as I could. And really the trick was being able to punch in and out cleanly enough so that, you know.
And those were pretty good. I think that I'm not sure if you had the same Fostex I had, but I had a Tascam too. But those things, you could punch in. I got really good at punching in to those things. So
what I would do is I would, you know, I would have the benefit of a doubled guitar, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like, it wouldn't be just like a rhythm guitar on one side. If I wanted that guitar doubled, I would figure out a way by using the three tracks that were remaining, even if I had to have that guitar doubled on three different tracks in different points in the song.
Well, yeah, and also when the vocal would stop, you would immediately put in whatever, you would use that space. There would be no blank spaces on any track. You would find something to put in those tracks. And so you start thinking about, you start thinking about arrangements as far as, yeah, as what can, four things that can happen at once.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so that's why I wanted to talk about four tracking. The other thing about Pray for Rain's four tracks, which I still have mm-hmm. copies of, is that you were working with live drums, which is something I rarely got to work with on my four tracks. The vast majority of my four tracks were drum machine. But I remember it was like, wow, that's real drums, but it's a four track. So you were doing, you know, you were setting up a mic or two.
Yep. Yeah, we would record. I think, as I recall, as I've kind of listened to this, it's like, I think it recorded bass and drums onto one track live in the studio. We concentrated on those. And then I think that Paul and I would play along, the other guitarist and I would play along. And so it would be in there, but like off. And then we would go back and we would come in and do the guitar part for real after we recorded those.
That's interesting because then if you did drums and bass at the same time, then they're frozen on one track. And then you and Paul would get a track each for your guitars, or would you guys, how would you do that?
I don't remember, Mike.
Because I actually remember on some of those songs that your rhythm guitar is definitely, it's mono with the bass and the drums. So at some point you must have bounced that too, you know, so open up another track. And then Paul would usually get a track and you probably had some sort of aug send with delay or something.
I think now that I'm thinking, okay, I think we recorded Jimmy, the drums, bass, and guitar, all, and me, the band all live except for vocals. And so we would do that onto two tracks, like a stereo onto two tracks, and then bring that back, and I would do vocals at my space, in my apartment.
Really? But then where would Paul's guitar be?
He'd been recorded live with when it went down initially. Because I was going to say, I think he may have done some overdubs, depending on which tracks it was, but we have some that are super live sounding, and it's definitely his live guitar tone that we wouldn't have been able to make happen at my apartment. So that all went down together at once. I guess the point is that we were forced to be creative with just four tracks. And that ended up making you think differently about arrangements, and it made four track a part of the experience and part of the craft and part of the art form.
Extending that to modern day recording, right? Or projecting it onto what people are doing today.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many recordings I hear, not people who know what they're doing, but people, you know, just your Joe songwriter in his bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
You want there always to be a focal point. That's so important with pop music.
Mm-hmm.
The vocal is your focal point. It always is. It always will be in pop music. But the minute that vocal drops out, something has to take its place. Something else has to come in. It could be a guitar line, some melody. Mm-hmm. It can be a rhythm. It can be a rhythmic thing. It could be more cowbell, boom, like, you know, like Blue Oyster Cult. I mean, but something has to come and take that focal point. There has to be something, because otherwise you just have a big empty space there.
Yeah, I mean, often dynamics will bring up the tracks that, you know, bring a writing, say a rhythm guitar up when the vocal goes away is something that people do, and that, which works depending on what's going on. So
it can work, but it's got to be a really interesting rhythm guitar.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, you'd have a part that actually was in conversation with the lead vocal.
Right. That's what's important, is that whatever other instrumentation you have in the song, it has to just fill that void.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are so many people right now recording, and you know, maybe they don't care because they're just songwriters and they're not really concerned about the production. But they have, you know, they have so much more at their fingertips than you and I had back in the 80s. And yet our four tracks still sound way better.
You know? Well, they do and they don't. Well, you know, what's interesting was that I've been thinking about this. Is I think that when you would play somebody a four track, you would just go, it would be obvious that it was sort of a lo-fi thing. And you actually gave it a lot more leeway as far as like being bad or good. It just like it's kind of a filter. It's like it kind of, yes, of course it's going to be kind of crappy because it's a four track. So you were kind of got away with more in a way. And it were not just sonically. I think that people just sort of, they, they lump the song. It's a pretty good song. It would be way better if we recorded it well. And that's not necessarily the case. And so I think we kind of get away with it sometimes just because like the audio quality is bad. It's hard for people to discern whether it's the song or the audio quality is bad.
Well, that's true. Yeah, and I've come across that many times.
Yeah.
Many, many people that I thought, oh, let me give them my demos. Like, you know, they just come back and say, well, you know, I don't, you know, you can tell they don't like it. And it's like, did they not like the song or was it just because it's a four track, you know?
Yeah. And I don't even know. I mean, so sometimes it's like, who knows? And I think that's something that a producer would, you know, a good producer would be able to pick out right away is the song. There's songs that aren't necessarily good songs, but I just love the production.
Right.
You know, but that's just because I'm an engineer producer kind of one. It's one of the hats that I wear. But there's a lot of, you know, especially in the 80s, there was like a lot of bands that were like big just because they had crazy ear candy in their songs, which were crazy enough that they were legitimate good songs because of their weird productions.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that's, you know, going back to one of the first things I said when we were talking about production and what production is those recordings that are not trying to capture, because let's be honest, there's two schools, right? There's the traditionalist school that says recording is just all you're doing is you're capturing a performance. That's more consistent with classical music and jazz. And I even say a lot of folk music and a lot of rock bands that are like live, like thrash metal and punk bands, mm-hmm. They're not really into overdubbing. They just want you to set up some mics and record what they do live.
Right.
And so there's that kind of recording. And there are good recordings of that style and there are bad recordings of that style. Mm-hmm. Usually when there are bad recordings, it's because the band just isn't that good and the recording is just capturing a bad band, mm-hmm. you know? But usually if the band is good and the engineer doesn't, and we use this term, don't get in the way of it. Just set up the mics and let it do its thing. Mm-hmm. So it's the easiest production job you could ever have, especially if you're not the one making the call as to what the takes are. Like if that's the take, if someone else in the room is saying, oh, I get to decide if that's the take, then you're really just engineering, right? But then there's the recordings like what you were just saying, where they're just loaded with ear candy, where honestly, the best example is when the Beatles decided, you know, they're not going to tour anymore and the Sgt. Pepper comes along. And it's like, okay, well, they would never be able to do this live anyway. I mean, because they'd have to have a full orchestra. I mean, I guess it's possible, but it would be a lot to do, you know? And so these recordings are more about just being works of art in their own right. Mm-hmm. You know, these are just, you can do a cover of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. I mean, Elton John did, and it's a good cover, you know, and John Lennon's playing guitar on it. And it did well, you know, it was a hit. But that original Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, it's just a one-of-a-kind recording. Or the same thing with Strawberry Fields, you know, mm-hmm. where George Martin is basically splicing two versions of Strawberry Fields and they were recorded at different tempos.
Yeah, at different times, at different tempos. Yeah, that's one of the most famous sort of kludges in pop history.
Yeah, and it's just a work of art. I mean, I just heard that song, I hadn't heard it in a while, and I heard it on the radio a few nights ago, and I just was like, man, this is such a, not just a great song, but what a great recording.
Yeah, and it's like the more you know about that, about how it was created, it gets even cooler as far as I'm concerned. So yeah, but I'm not sure. But it also stands, I mean, and so you and I are the kind of people that appreciate all that, but it also works completely as a song, just as a song played on a piano or a guitar and a vocal. It's just a great song.
It is, but it's not as good. I mean, I have a version of Lennon playing it.
Oh, no. Yeah,
acoustic guitar, and he's just singing it.
Yes, but what makes it a great moment in pop history is that recording that George Martin.
I mean, how many Bob Dylan songs have you heard that are like great songs, great lyrics, but come on, there's just nothing going on there production-wise. It's more from that school of folk music where you, once again, you just don't get in the way of it.
It's true. You and I aren't going to necessarily, I mean, even though, yes, I do love Bob Dylan, I always have, but yeah, it's like, I need to have more than that. I need to have this stuff that we're talking about.
Right.
To keep me interested.
And, you know, to close this episode, I'm just saying that starting with four tracks is a great place to start because like you did, and I know I did way back in the day, we did accomplish that. We did record songs on four tracks and we did have enough ear candy, you know, despite the fact that what you're saying is true, that the sonic quality, yeah, it's just a little shitty four track on a cassette. Okay, mm-hmm. fine. But that doesn't take away from the fact that if I still listen to a Pray for Rain song from you guys recorded in like 1988 or something or 89, I still get something out of it, you know? Like I still appreciate the fact that you went that one extra step, you know?
Yes.
To give me enough ear candy. It's like, hey, this is a really good song, but I like the recording too.
Yeah.
And I'm you know, I'm forgiving on the fact that I know it's a little 4-track on a cassette. Dance on tables all night long. Take your hat off to the moon. But if you ever marry that one genie, you can count your days as true. We deserve the best from this little town, but the best things have a price.
Yeah, that's actually, yeah, I mean, I have my own relationship with my old past material, and some of it I'm happy with, but a lot of it I'm just like, what was I thinking? But I do always appreciate that aspect of it. It's like, yeah, we were at least we're trying to make it sound produced with, you know, perhaps inverted commas, overproduced, you know, so it is, we were always trying, that was always the fun part of it, was trying to get it as produced as we could, and that's what I really liked. That was the craft of it for me.
Okay, so next time we are going to get into 8-track recording. And with 8-track recording, we will definitely be talking about sequencing and MIDI and that kind of stuff.
Do you still have my 8-track recorder?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
If you like this podcast, please subscribe. Leave us 5 stars and a review. Thanks.